Welcome to Civil Discourse. This podcast will use government documents to illuminate the workings of the American government and offer context around the effects of government agencies in your everyday life. And now your hosts, Nia Rogers, Public Affairs Librarian, and Dr. John Augenbaugh, Political Science Professor.
Hey, Augie.
Good morning, Nia. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, I'm lovely, of course, because I get to talk about one of my favorite documents, the United States Constitution.
And which we have established you sleep with underneath your pillow at night.
Yes.
So that it seeps into your brain while you're... Isn't that how it works to study for things? I'm pretty sure some of your students study that way. They put your class notes under their pillow and hope for the best.
Is it learning by osmosis?
That's right.
Listeners, this is part two of an episode where we are discussing things that are not in the Constitution.
Yes, and if you're curious about the previous episode, that was things that didn't make it in because they got sort of dissed. Right. Like Madison came up with all these sort of flowery things. And then later on, other people came up with flowery things and said, hey, let's put these in the Constitution. And everybody else went, nah, we're good.
Yeah. So, the previous episode was the proposed amendments that for whatever reason or reasons just didn't make the grade. OK.
And now what we're talking about. So if you've seen the movie The Princess Bride.
Yes.
One of the characters regularly says, inconceivable. And then another character says to him, I do not think this word means what you think it means. And it has first of all, that's Mandy Patinkin, who is is a gem in our acting sphere.
Yeah. But also, one of the greatest American actors of the last half century.
Oh, okay? He's marvelous. And yes. And also I think sometimes about the Constitution. I do not think that means what you think it means, right? Like I think when people say certain things about the Constitution, I hear him in my head. Because I think that people think there's a lot of stuff in there that's not in there. And I know that you have a list that you want to talk about of things that are not in there that you think are in there.
Yeah.
Can we start with my favorite?
Yeah, go ahead.
So my favorite is I have a right to privacy.
Correct.
And I hate to break this to any listeners. The founders didn't give a tinker's darn about your privacy or anybody's privacy. They did not have the concept of privacy for a variety of reasons. One, whole bunch of people living in a relatively small space, right? Like,
yes.
So, you know, you have servants or slaves or what have you living in those spaces with you. They just were not alone. They didn't have privacy in that way. And the other thing is, they also lived on farms that were distant from other people.
Yeah, so you could go weeks, if not months, without seeing any official from the government.
Or without seeing anybody neighbor-wise, unless you saw them on Sunday at church. Like,
Yeah, fair point. But in terms of, you know, the right to privacy, the right to be left alone.
Oh, by the government?
By the government intrusion.
You saw that guy once a year when he came to collect taxes.
That's it, right?
And you saw the postal delivery guy who didn't have any interest in what you were doing with your mail. Like, he just had a job to do. He was showing up, handing you stuff and moving on. Like,
yes.
So their concept of privacy was just, it just didn't exist the way it exists now. And so am I correct that there is absolutely no evidence of the word privacy in the Constitution?
That is correct. There is no specific reference to privacy in the Constitution. However, because of various Supreme Court rulings, we now have a right to privacy that, according to the court, can be traced to a number of amendments. So, for instance, Nia, the Ninth Amendment states that just because there is a listing of rights in the Bill of Rights does not mean the people don't possess other rights.
Oh, right. Okay. Oh, right. Sorry.
Yes. Right. Okay. But gotcha. Of course, it begs the question, what are these other
rights,
other enumerated rights not listed in the Constitution? Well, according to the Supreme Court, starting with the case of Griswold versus Connecticut in 1965, the court has developed and expanded this right to privacy. And in Griswold, it was the right of married couples to choose or not to use contraception.
Oh, that's a thing that shouldn't be anybody else's business.
Ah, okay. And by the way, a strong majority of the court agrees with you, Nia, right?
That's because I'm right.
Well, of course.
I mean, hello.
But what was interesting was that there was a majority opinion and four separate concurring opinions because they could not agree where to locate or base the right to privacy. Okay.
That's awesome. Okay. It's not in here technically, but it's in here kind of implied somewhere. So we're all going to choose different places that we think it's implied. But 1965, see, that's a very modern.
It is a very modern
view of,
yes.
Right. View of the.
Okay.
Because if Madison had the conception of a right to privacy, one could argue that he would have written it in there explicitly.
Yes. Okay.
Implied means that he just assumed, well, of course you have privacy. But how would you not have privacy? Couldn't see a future where, I mean, think about the cities then were just not nearly the size that they are now. People weren't living on top of each other the way they are now. The government wasn't nearly as intrusive as, and it wasn't ever, in his mind, intended to be intrusive. I mean, this is that whole anti-federalist, right? The government shouldn't be this intrusive overseer that knows all the things, including, oh my goodness, your contraceptive habits, which is just mind-blowing to me that anybody would have to bring a legal case to have a discussion about who should know about your reproductive
marital
habits in that way.
Yeah,
like,
marital
oh
relations. Yeah.
Yeah, no.
And then 2 years later, the Supreme Court, in the case of Katz versus United States, which was a Fourth Amendment case, went ahead and said that the Fourth Amendment protected people, not places, and that the standard to judge the government conducting searches and seizures should be a reasonable expectation of privacy acknowledged or accepted by the public. So this is where you begin to see.
So they can't do a full body cavity search of your person for a traffic stop.
Yes.
Because that would be considered an invasion of your privacy. And boy, would it, because that would happen on the side of the road too, which would be.
Okay, well, scary. I mean, and again, this gets to this notion of, you know, expectation of privacy, right? Okay.
Or non-expectation of privacy, because if you're out in public, I mean, like, I know there have been cases about you can't take my picture, right? Because lots of businesses and governments have cameras set up all over a city to watch for crime, to do all kinds of things, right? There's lots of reasons why you would do that. But that if you go out in a city, you don't really have an expectation that you can prevent people from taking your picture. If you're outside, then you've sort of let go of the right of privacy.
Or, I mean, the classic example is, let's say the police bring you in for questioning. Can they go ahead and record your conversation or anything that you say? Sure, because you have no reasonable expectation of privacy in a police station.
Right.
However, if your attorney shows up and then says to the cops, turn off the recording devices because I'm going to have a confidential conversation with my client, then the cops have to. Okay.
Do they have to? I wonder if they have to if the lawyer doesn't ask for that.
Well, technically, they could probably try to get around it. But if they get the wrong judge, the judge would say, come on now, okay?
You knew that there was an expectation
of privacy,
a privilege, right? Yes, a privilege, okay, between a client and a lawyer. So it gets complicated, but I think it's interesting. Your case that you brought up is 1960s. I mean, we go a long time without there being this question.
Yes.
Because people don't assume a right to privacy. They don't assume that their neighbors and their police officers and their town officials don't know what everybody's doing. And just speaking as a person who comes from a small town, they do know what everybody's doing. If I had committed a crime downtown, by the time I got home, my parents would be ready for a beating, because everybody between downtown and my house would have called my parents and said, did you see what she, you don't know what she did down here, but I saw her doing graffiti. And the next thing you know, I'd be in for a whooping, because there's
the
expectation for privacy in a small town.
Yeah. Right. I mean, the cops never had to get search warrants in my small hometown.
Nope.
All they had to do was just sit back and wait. Okay. For the rumor mill, the conversation mill, to get back to a police officer who might be at the local Dunkin' Donuts. Okay. And by the time I would get home, my mother knew, my sisters knew, right, my grandmother knew, my uncles knew. Okay. And all of them wanted to have conversations, and I'm using air quotes, conversations with me.
Right. Okay. So it's just funny, because that's a whole separate sort of vigilante question.
Of course, Nia, before we move on from the right of privacy, the big one, the right to privacy was extended by the Supreme Court in Roe v. Wade, claiming that the right to privacy included a woman's right to choose whether to have an abortion or not.
Oh, I didn't know that's what that was founded in.
It is rooted in the right to privacy.
Oh, interesting.
Yes.
Okay. So, and that's 73, 4? Yeah.
73. So within a decade, we go from not having a clearly recognized right to privacy to the Supreme Court issuing, you know, groundbreaking rulings that say,
you have this expectation implied.
But and here's the thing, this conversation that you and I are having is pointing to how nebulous the right to privacy truly is, because if the membership on the court changes,
right,
and you get a whole bunch of strict constructionists on the court, okay, they can go ahead and quite easily say,
It's not in the Constitution.
So,
and implied isn't the same thing as being in there.
Explicitly stated. So they could quite easily say, as strict constructionists are fond of saying, if the people want, you know, a change to the Constitution,
there's a way to do that.
There's a way to do it. And we're not it.
Right. And you would need to look at the legislative, you would need to be giving side eye to the legislative branch, because it's in fact their job to do that, not the law. So that's where that may turn again.
Yes.
Depending on the, but there are some things that are sort of immutably not in there.
Yes. That people repeat, claim all the time. And when they do, Nia, it takes everything I have not to go ahead and just play devil's advocate with.
Yeah, me, cite, right? Your source. What part of the Constitution is that in? I'm going to need you to tell me which of the articles you found that in. And when they go, until you've read the document, don't tell me what's in it.
I so badly
the Constitution and the Bible fall into these categories
of where people say,
oh, I know it's in there somewhere.
And I'm just like, okay, fine. Where is it in the Bible? And
exactly.
They're like, huh? And I said, no, seriously. Because I said, I've read and studied the Bible, and you're making a claim of which I'm unfamiliar.
Right.
Okay. Likewise with the Constitution. You know, I've studied, researched it, taught it for years. and I'll just give you one of the examples. Okay. Innocent until proven guilty. That's not in the Constitution, okay? It is not in the Constitution.
The Constitution, now, actually, technically, correct me if I'm wrong, Augie, but I think that the Constitution doesn't care whether you're innocent or guilty. It cares what can be proved in a court of law.
Yeah.
Your innocence or guilt is not actually relevant, except as to going to prove what legally happened, right?
The emphasis in the Constitution, and I tell my students this all the time. I said, if you look at the 4th, 5th, 6th, and to a certain extent, the 8th Amendments, those are the amendments that give you rights if you're accused of crime. They don't, the Constitution doesn't care if you actually committed the crime. It gives you rights that force the government to jump through hoops to demonstrate that you did.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Because they have to prove a thing.
Yeah, they have to prove a thing. It's an adversarial system.
And which is good. We don't want the system to be assuming guilt, you are and guilty. Then you have to prove your innocence, because that's a lot more expensive and onerous on the individual. It should be up to the state to prove that you are guilty, because it has the larger resources to do that. Like it puts the financial and social burden on the party that has more of the resources than on the other party.
Because in effect, Nia, the state is claiming you harmed the community.
Right. You harmed the state. Yeah. The state being everybody else around you.
Yeah. Because the government represents the collective.
Right.
Okay. And this is an individual right. So it basically goes ahead and says to the state, well, if you're going to claim that Nia, is this no good blah, 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 who did X, well, you're going to have to jump through hoops, because otherwise we assume, she's a member of good standing.
But that comes from, that doesn't come from the Constitution, though. That concept
is British common law.
Okay.
Is British common law, right? And, judges,
I'm assuming that you're a decent person until someone proves otherwise.
Yeah, and if you want to root it into political philosophy, Nia, it comes from classic republicanism, small r, not Republican Party. Classic republicanism emphasizes the collective, right? But the Constitution protects the individual. And that's classic liberalism, small l, right? Okay. And of course, my students are just like, but, and I said, you are guaranteed a process. Okay. It's called due process of law. If the government wants to abridge your life, liberty, or property, and by the way, if they take you to court and you're found guilty, you may lose your liberty and your life. And in some cases, if you spend enough time in jail, your property. So the burden's on the government. But the system itself does not necessarily assume that you are innocent. The system doesn't care.
Right.
The system doesn't care, right? Likewise.
The system only cares what it can prove.
Yes, right? Likewise, people believe that they have a right to a fair trial. Well, Nia, you've heard me say this before. Fair is a four-letter dirty word as it comes to the U.S. Constitution.
That's right. In George Carlin's list of dirty words, fair should have been one of them, as far as the Constitution is concerned,
right?
Because fair could not be more subjective. Yes. Like, that's the problem with that concept, is that fair is wildly subjective. What I think of as a fair trial and what you think of as a fair trial would be wildly different. I know that, you're guaranteed a speedy trial, right? Like they can't just make you languish waiting for legal redress.
Yeah. So Nia, what you're referencing is the fact that the Sixth Amendment in particular has a number of, if you will, rights for those accused of crime, right? Or correct. I'm going to use correct here, because we're right. Rights. Okay.
So, exactly.
So you have various rights if you're accused of crime.
So
including, go ahead, Nia.
In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense.
That's right. So these are all things that you have access to. But notice, Nia, what you just read, did it ever say a fair trial?
Nope.
No. So technically,
could
the state give you a trial with all those elements and the trial still be quote unquote unfair?
Oh, I think so.
Yeah.
They have to give you a public and speedy trial by an impartial jury.
Yes.
Where the crime happened.
And
they have to allow you to call witnesses, and they have to allow you to have an attorney, to assistance. You have to have assistance for your counsel, and you get to confront your witnesses, meaning you get to ask them questions.
That's right.
But all of that could be met without being
a fair trial.
What people would consider to be fair. And usually what people consider to be fair is what goes in their favor. That's the other thing.
Well, yeah.
Is that whenever you lose, you're like,
well that isn't fair. And I said, and I'll ask, why isn't it fair? It's kind of sort of like a conversation I have with, my daughter. Okay.
Right. Because I lost. Okay, well, that doesn't make it inherently unfair, sweetie.
it reminds me of a funny anecdote. The first time her basketball team played a game, right, they lost. And she comes, moping off the court. And I said, well, what's up, Mackenzie? And she goes, well, that wasn't fair. And I said, because you lost? And she goes, yes. She looked at me like,
like, what's wrong with you? Of course, that's obvious.
And I was just like, but you got to play 4 8-minute quarters. Uh-huh. Did the refs call fouls? Yes.
Did they call them on both sides?
Sides.
Yes.
And she goes, and she looked at me and she goes, I don't know. She goes, but we lost. And I said, yes, but it was still fair. It was a fair game. Okay. You just lost. Okay, no biggie.
Yeah, you just lost.
But there's a related one that you mentioned as you were listing the rights in the Sixth Amendment.
Okay. Yes.
And that is, people believe that the Constitution protects a right to a jury of your peers. No, it doesn't.
It's an impartial jury.
Yes. Okay.
It says nothing about your
about peers. A jury of one's peers. Okay. Because the reality is, it would be almost impossible,
right,
for a court system to get an exact replica of your peers to serve as a jury.
Okay? Right. I'm going to need you to get all female librarians in their, 40s and 50s to...
In a small rural town in North Carolina, blah, blah, blah. No, who was raised in a religious family. Yeah. Look at all those disqualifying.
Exactly.
Variables,
that's right? Not. And what's interesting is that question comes up a lot in terms of race.
Yes.
In juries where they will say the defendant is African-American and there were no African-Americans on the jury. They only require that the jury be impartial, not that the jury be the same race as the individual being tried. And
yes. And in fact, heretofore, Nia, the Supreme Court has held that there are only two criteria that cannot be used for discriminatory purposes in putting together a jury. And you actually mentioned one, race, and the other one is gender, okay?
Oh, they can't keep persons of color off the jury and they can't keep women off the jury deliberately.
Or vice versa, right?
Okay.
You know, you can't go ahead and say, well, because the victim was, you know, a person of color, then everybody on the jury has to be a person of color. Okay, no.
Right.
Right? Okay, right. Likewise, you can't exclude women because you believe that women will always vote a certain way in a certain type of trial. No, you can't do that, right? Right. But those are the only two criteria. Otherwise, it has to be an impartial jury. So that's why when you are called for jury duty, and if you get actually called to be a potential juror for a case, you get asked a whole bunch of questions by the defense attorney, by the prosecuting attorney, and in some cases, the judge, to ascertain whether or not you can be impartial.
Right.
The last time I got called for jury duty, okay, my number got called to be a potential juror in a case. And when the defense attorney asked for my education and background, and I related, the judge excluded me for cause. And I went ahead and asked, why am I being excluded for cause? And the judge goes, because you know more about the jury system than probably all of us do. You can't be impartial.
See, well, I wanted to serve for years and was not called. And I was finally called for jury duty, and I was so excited. And I went and I read through the document, and I was going to a conference later that week, and it was one that would have lasted 2 weeks.
Yeah.
They expected it to last 2 weeks. So one of the disqualifying factors was if you can't serve every day. And so I called the court and I told them that. And then I went in and had to tell the judge that. I went in because you go in and you all sit on these rows. And then if they're removing you for a variety, are you taking care of a dependent individual? Right. Meaning you can't be here in court all day long. Are you right? There are certain things like that then people will get up and leave. And then they said, does anybody have anything else? And I stood up and I said, as I have said to the court before, I am due at an academic conference that's been paid for by the state at the end of the week. And she looked through the papers and she found mine and she said, then you're dismissed. And I was really upset because I wanted to serve in that way because I think people shouldn't avoid jury duty. I don't think it's something to get out of. I think you get a far greater understanding of a system if you sit in it and marinate in it. It's one of those things where, you know, like I've learned more about grievances at the university having sat on panels where you hear people's stories, and then you're like, oh, there's whole different dimensions here that I didn't even think about. So I'm you know, but the other thing is it was a child molestation case, and so in some ways I'm grateful that I was not part of it, because that's a horrible thing to have to hear. That's the flip side of that jury thing. I understand why people want to get out of certain kinds, because they just don't want to hear sort of man's inhumanity to man kind of thing. But I would encourage anybody who gets a jury notice to serve if you can. I think it's a good way to see how the judicial system works, and in some cases doesn't work. I mean,
yeah. And though I got excluded the last time I was called, I've actually served on 3 juries. And as you pointed out, I mean, not only was I predisposed to want to serve, because I am a believer that we have obligations as citizens,
right,
to participate in the functioning of our society. In one of the cases was a date rape case, and it was not by any stretch, a positive experience as a jury member. But nevertheless, if there was ever going to be potential justice for the victim, you know, the individual had to be prosecuted. There had to be a jury, and we had to keep an open mind.
Right.
Okay. We had to keep an open mind.
You have to hear all of the, you have speaking to hear all of the parts of it.
So yeah, speaking of citizen obligation, segue, many Americans believe that in the original Constitution, there is a clearly identified right to vote. There is not, okay? There is not. There is no explicit right stated, okay? So it's not
I laugh because the founders were wealthy, landowning, educated, white males. And they would have thought, well, we're the ones to vote. We're the ones to make the decisions for the rest of the country. We don't want the unwashed masses.
And in the original Constitution, qualifications, restrictions, the time, place, and manner of voting was left to the states, because the assumption of many framers was the states would actually protect and have a better idea about who could vote,
right,
instead of having a uniform national, if you will, set of criteria.
Well, it's interesting. You've used the word now, original Constitution. You've used that phrase now a few times. Do you mean non-amendments Constitution? Yeah. Is that what you're referencing when you say original?
To the original or main text. They're talking about the document that was drafted in Philadelphia in 1787 and was ratified by 1789.
They're talking about the three articles. They're talking about that document. They're not
the seven articles.
They're not talking about when you get to the
Bill of Rights, which are the first 10 amendments. Now, interestingly enough,
seven
articles. It is with certain amendments, okay, that we have expanded the right to vote, right? So, for instance, the 15th Amendment. Says that voting cannot be denied to those that were previously enslaved. So you're talking about former male slaves were given the right to vote with the 15th.
I was going
to
say, only males.
Only males, right? Now, we get the 19th Amendment, okay, which gave women the right to vote. Subsequent amendments, for instance, gave 18-year-olds the right to vote. Certain amendments also prohibit certain kinds of practices that made it more difficult to vote, right? So there was an amendment passed in the 1960s that prohibited poll taxes, you know, to where you had to pay a tax before you could vote.
Right.
Okay? But nevertheless, there is nothing that clearly states in the U.S. Constitution that individuals have a right to vote in the United States.
Okay? Which is weird because they do talk about electors. They talk about Congress in terms of being elected. So it's not that they were sort of ignorant of the process of election, right? They understood voting.
It's just that they left it to the states. And as we discussed in a previous podcast episode, very early on, many states did what you described, Nia. They limited voting to land-owning white males. Now, there were some states that allowed women to vote, but that quickly ended. this country has a checkered history with voting.
Right.
You know, and I tell my students this who want to talk about all the debates about state laws that make it easier or tougher to vote. I'm like, hey, guys, this is not a brand new debate. We have been debating who can vote and how easy it should be to vote for the entirety of our country's history. Right. And they're like, well, there should be one set uniform standard. And I said, oh. So if you are in Virginia, you have no problem with California voting laws. Or I said, if or are you comfortable with New York? Because New York actually has some of the more stringent voting laws in the country. They're like, well, that can't be right. New York's a liberal state. And I'm like, it doesn't matter if it's liberal or conservative. Because like I said, at times, liberal states enacted restrictive voting laws.
Right.
If it serves the purposes of that dominant party, then they will use, okay, the authority given to states in the Constitution to make it more difficult for their opponents to vote. And they're like, well, that ain't right. And I said, well, probably it isn't right. Okay. But you know what would change it? And they're like, what? I said, wait for it. Amend the Constitution.
And right.
They're like, oh man.
Now you're talking about a huge thing. And, you know, one of the reasons that it's hard to amend the Constitution is because you don't want it to happen willy-nilly.
Yeah, you want there to be,
you want there to be national buy-in.
Yeah, it's permanent change that becomes the supreme law of the country.
Right.
So, by the way, you ready to move on to one more?
I am, but okay, which one do you want to move on to?
Well, the one that I hear a lot from my friends who were born in other countries and come to the United States, and they're fascinated by the bigness, the sheer size of the country, because they assume that Americans have what right? The right to travel. And I'm like, you know, that's not a constitutional right. And they're like, but there's all those movies where Americans just get in cars and they drive up to Maine, or they drive out to California, or they drive.
Get in the car, kids. We're going to the Grand Canyon.
Or, you know, hey, you know, I'm just going to escape my crappy living conditions in X town and X city, and I'm just going to drive. You guys got a right to travel. I'm like, there's no constitutional right to travel. And it just blows their mind, because there is nothing in the U.S. Constitution that says you have a right to travel. Now, once again,
and there's nothing in the U.S. Constitution that says that a state cannot close its borders.
That's correct.
It would be, I'm sure that the lawsuit would be based in the Commerce Clause.
Sure would be.
But yep. Because everything in Augie's life comes back to the Commerce Clause. He comes eats back it for to breakfast.
Commerce. Yes.
But until that lawsuit, a state could say, you're not coming here. And in fact, during the pandemic, states that were doing that. We had states that were saying, oh, wait, you're from a highly contagious place. You can't come here without proof that you're not sick or whatever.
If you do come here, you're going to get quarantined. You're going to get quarantined for 10 to 14 days, right?
Right.
Okay. Because, you know, we have former students who went to other states for like graduate school or law school. And they email me. They're like, yeah, I just got to, you know, Pennsylvania, and I was basically told I had to quarantine for 10 days. You know, right. Welcome to law school.
And that, I mean, if there was an automatic right to travel, they wouldn't be able to do that. So yes. Because that's up to the states, they can close off travel if they want to. Now, does it hurt them? Probably. It probably hurts them financially. It probably hurts them socially, but it also might protect their citizenry from who knows what, right? We don't, you know.
And once again, Nia, who has interpreted the Constitution to give us at least some notion of a right to travel?
Oh, the Supremes.
Yeah, the Supreme
Court. It always falls into the lap of the Supremes.
Yeah, the Supreme Court in 1958, in the case of Kent versus Dulles, went ahead and said that one could find a right to travel in the liberty part of the due process clause. That you really
is that the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness? No.
Oh, Nia.
Different document. Different document.
You're killing me.
Oh, I can't believe I said those words out. Life, liberty, and happiness
comes from the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, I know. I said those words and immediately thought, awooga, that's a mistake. Awooga. Oh, well. I've made a mistake.
Wait. What's that from? Awooga.
Oh, it's a submarine diving. Awooga, dive. Awooga, okay. You have a mistake.
I'm thinking there's a Disney movie that I've endured, you know, watching countless times with my daughter.
Probably.
Okay.
Probably something from my childhood, a cartoon or a movie Will Robinson, danger. Yes.
But, you know, some scholars say that a right to travel, once again, could be rooted in the Ninth Amendment. Okay. You know, it's an unenumerated right. You have this right in nature. Okay.
Right.
But nevertheless.
Or correct.
Okay.
Sorry. I keep saying right because that's my agreement word.
Yeah.
There's
a whole generation of Americans, okay, much to the chagrin of English teachers, okay, that learned how to give affirmation to right.
Exactly.
Right.
As opposed to correct. Correct sounds a little formal and stiff.
Yeah.
To that generation of people, and I'm one of those.
You know, correct is pretentious. But there's a whole bunch of English teachers that would go ahead and tell us right denotes direction. Okay. Correct means somebody, you know, has been affirmed. Right.
Right. Correct.
You gave the correct answer. You don't give the right answer because, Mr. Agabaugh, right denotes direction. Okay, yes, Sister Mary Agnes.
I was going to say.
Yeah, right.
It's got to be a nun, but yes. Also they are correct.
Yeah.
But you could see it in part of the liberty idea of the founding of the country, that the founders just assumed the right to travel. They just assumed that you could go wherever you wanted to go. That was the whole point of coming here, was that you could show up, because, get off a boat, start walking.
Because many of the colonists were leaving Great Britain or other European nations because their liberty, whether it be religious, economic, or just a desire
or physical,
not to no longer serve as a serf. Okay, in a feudal economic system, was limited.
Right.
They wanted liberty. You can come
to the United States and starve here, but you can do it as a free person.
Yeah.
Basically, what the promise of the early country was.
The promise of
the early country is the promise of it now, which is you can come here and make something of yourself in a way that a previous system may or may not have let you, which is why we still have immigration today. We have this idea of, I will go there and make a different life for myself.
Yes. And that's why
through the power of my hard work,
create a new existence. That's why there are a number of political scientists and economists who believe that voting with one's feet is probably the most effective way of voting. That if you don't like what's going on in a particular state or a particular, for instance, city, if you really want to send a really strong message to the powers to be, you move.
Yes, as is happening with 3/4 of the population of California, which seems to be moving to Texas.
Or Wyoming or Montana.
Right. They're like, heck with this mess, right? And then they,
and of course, now they're getting out. Yeah, and of course now the locals in Texas, Wyoming, and Montana are saying, "What are these liberal Californians doing?"
What are these carpetbaggers doing coming into
our pristine land?
But you get, after the Dust Bowl, you get Okies.
Yes.
And people from Arkansas and Kansas who moved to California looking for work. There's all that issue there. So I want to ask you about something else that's not in the Constitution, but I think people think is in the Constitution.
Okay.
And that is what you just alluded to with the Supreme Court, the Supremes having the right to decide anything. Because as we have noted in past, the Supreme Court article in the Constitution is almost afterthoughty.
Oh, it's very limited. It's extremely narrow.
Like an afterthought. Right, we need some courts. Let's put in a note about the court. But it is hot in here, so keep it short, because I want to go home and not be in this small room with you 80 lunatics or whatever. So it doesn't get a whole lot of
attention.
Like, it's not even in the Constitution that judicial review will be a thing, that the Supremes can look at something and decide whether it's constitutional or not, right? We have an episode on that. That's Marbury v. Madison. That's John Jay. Is it John Jay?
John Marshall.
John Marshall. Thank you. Sorry. My Johns. Saying, you know what? We really should have the right to look over something and see if it's constitutional. I think we'll take that right. And everybody going, yeah, that's great. Because at the
least initially, not everybody thought it was great.
Well,
I mean, you know, recall Thomas Jefferson basically knew that he won that case.
But lost the war.
But he lost the war, right?
Right.
Because now you got an entire branch of the federal government that is wholly unaccountable to the public, right?
Gets to decide the authority of the constitutionality of something.
Yeah, the meaning of the Constitution. The courts have the final word, right?
Yeah, that's huge. It's such a beautiful move. When you go back and listen to that episode, you can hear my admiration. I'm like, oh, that was beautiful. Well, such a gorgeous power grab that didn't even look like one at the time and has become a thing that now we all assume is just true. We just assume, well, of course the Supremes will decide a thing.
And
there's absolutely no constitutional reason that they should be deciding what's constitutional and what's not.
Not constitutional, right? Because if the framers thought that this was so god-awful important, they would have gone ahead and listed it as a power, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
On the other hand, again, is we have discussed in a number of episodes, the framers of the U.S. Constitution didn't create a perfect document. They left stuff out of it to where today we're just like, what was going on in Philadelphia in 1787? They didn't think that they should go ahead and include X in there.
Right.
And judicial review is one of those. Now, there are some scholars, Nia, who believe that the framers assumed that every court would exercise judicial review because every state court at that time exercised judicial review. On the other hand, as Jefferson pointed out, okay, in his in a number of letters to Madison after Marbury versus Madison, this was a power grab. Okay, this was your garden variety. A court saying, we're going to go ahead and do X, and it's not in the Constitution. So if you're a strict constructionist, judicial review should give you pause.
If you're a strict constructionist, you shouldn't be on the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
I'm just saying. But so in your face, strict constructionists.
Did you say reconstructionist or strict constructionist?
Okay. The other part of my hindbrain that listens to you, I know you think I don't, but I do, is that we really do need a court that stands above the other courts, because if you get into, and we have this on a regular basis, courts dispute at the state levels.
Yes.
So two state courts hear two different cases, and they come to two different conclusions about the Colorado River, something that we will discuss in a podcast. By the time you hear this, we will have discussed it, but I'm not sure it will be out yet. But, you know, if Colorado and Wyoming decide to do different things with the river, someone has to settle that dispute. So there does have to be a sort of an overarching court.
Yeah, and it's
a power grab, but it's also a not unreasonable thing once you get 50 states who are all complaining and jostling and trying to get their way on things.
Yeah, and it's one of the justifications Marshall writes in the Marbury case, which is, if the Constitution is going to be the supreme law, there has to be some institution that says what that supreme law means. You know, we can't leave it up to 50 states.
Right. Because then we have 50 different
views. We can't leave it up to one session of Congress, which acts in a different way than a previous session of Congress. We can't have every new president claiming the Constitution says X, and then it changes when we elect a new president. Okay.
Right.
That's not a democratic.
That's a mess.
Yeah, that's not a democratic form of government.
It's a messy form of government.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's bordering on anarchy.
Right.
Okay. And you know.
Then it becomes deal making. Like then, what starts to happen is states will start to make deals.
And then you know then the meaning of the Constitution is left up to, you know, which groups can cut the best deals.
Right.
And again.
Or have the most power or have the most. Yeah, that just turns into a mess. So for our final two things that are not in the Constitution.
Yes.
And I think they go together sort of.
Yes, they do.
You alluded to one earlier, which is the right to procreate.
Yes.
There is no right to procreate, or in the case of the privacy case, not procreate, Griswold v. Connecticut, right? There's no right of procreation there's nothing in the Constitution that says if you have a child, the state will support it.
Yeah, there's nothing in the Constitution that says states should allow you to have kids.
And there's nothing in the Constitution, likewise, that says that states can prevent you from having children.
That's correct.
Right, okay. which becomes a case where people have disabilities.
Yes.
And there have been eugenic questions about whether they should have children or not. That's not up to the state. That's not an ethical or moral decision that the state should be involved in. And so the Constitution steers clear of that by saying we have the state has no business in your.
And again, this then touches upon what are the, you know, historical legal traditions of the country, which is extremely nebulous, okay? But again, you know, we're talking about a country that before it existed as a country were a set of colonies. And in some of the charters with the British Crown, there was actually language about procreation.
That you're going to go forth and have children? And
yeah, because, you know.
And again, that they will be subjects of the crown and that they will be supportive of the crown.
Any of your offspring will also be subjects of the crown that have to comply with the charter that this particular colony has with the crown. And again, you're talking about a different economic system. Nia, you and I have talked about how the United States, when it was agrarian, kids were not viewed as quote unquote autonomous individuals that may grow up and do whatever they want.
Oh no.
Kids were viewed as
property.
Workers. Okay.
Property of their parents.
Yeah. Their role was to go ahead and make the farm work.
Right.
Okay.
And because they died in droves, you had a bunch of them.
That's right. Okay.
Back in the day when people had 10 or 12 children.
There is no discussion in the Constitution about you individually having a right to have kids or the state's ability or not having the authority to restrict it.
But I want to point something out in your notes because it's fascinating to me.
Yeah.
That the state, if a state banned procreation or required licenses for procreation, it would not violate the Constitution.
Correct.
Now, I rather jokingly, because I am not a parent, often say to people, there ought to be a license for that, the way there's a license to be a driver, right? You shouldn't be allowed to just go random out making babies without having some sort of basic knowledge of how that should should work. And there's nothing that says the state can't do that. That you
think about this, that
you're going to be a parent, male or female, they find out you're going to be a parent, that you are required to take some sort of course in child development, in child endangerment, like how do you prevent things?
Well, think about this, Nia.
It would be great.
Think about this, Nia. There is actually a corollary to that. Many states require parents who adopt children to go through
classes.
Yes.
And those families get regularly checked on to make sure that everything's going well, at least in the first few years.
Yes.
Maybe that should just be the case for all families. And then that way I would think there would be less child abuse. There would be less, right? There would be, and you would know about problems earlier and you might be able to solve them earlier rather than having horrible childhoods.
Or think about if that was a requirement in high school, the number of young people who would be less likely.
Right. to have children before they're ready to do so. Likewise, I'm not entirely certain that there should not be licenses for getting married in the sense of you have to take a class. Now, some religions require that. Right. Yes. Like I know that in the Catholic Church, if you're going to get married, you have to see a priest and there's work that you have to do ahead of time in order to make sure that you're both on the same page and you understand what marriage is about and that kind of thing, which I think being led by people who may or may not be married seems a little weird, but whatever. It's not my faith and it's all cool. But I'm wondering if so the state of Virginia could do that for everybody, right? They could say, before we issue this license, you have to take here's how to be married to another person and deal with all of that class.
Yeah, because
there's nothing that would say that they couldn't do that, right?
Yeah, because there's no right to marriage in the Constitution. And a lot of my students end up being shocked when I go in and tell them that according to states, it's a privilege. And in many states, marriage is basically a contract. There's not a right, okay? So like any contract, could a state put conditions before you enter into the contract? Sure, okay?
But they can't put the condition of
they cannot discriminate racial... because, yeah, they cannot discriminate based on race and because of Obergefell versus Hodges on sexual orientation. Okay.
Right, Loving v. Virginia is the case about race, right?
The United States Supreme Court in the Loving versus Virginia case, 1967, said that states cannot prohibit interracial marriage.
And it's not because they cared a huge amount about the race issue as much as they cared about the equality issue. If you're not telling two white people they can't get married, then you can't tell a black and a white person that they can't get married.
Because what you're talking about is a government practice that would violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment.
Got it.
But as a number of constitutional scholars have pointed out, could a state ban marriage for all of its citizens? Theoretically, the answer is yes.
Oh, I'm starting a single state.
Okay, because
I'm going to carve off, I don't know where I'm going to carve off a piece of. Hmm.
Because theoretically, Nia, everybody would be treated the same.
Right. No one here can get married.
Nobody can get married.
It's not based in race. It's not based in sexual preference or gender identity or anything else.
No.
Nobody here can be married.
And by the way, I get asked this question by a lot of my younger
students. I actually wouldn't do that. That wouldn't be fun. And marriages are good for a lot of people.
Some people,
they thrive. Flourish. Some people thrive during marriage.
Yeah, they flourish.
And some people thrive multiple times during marriage, right? Like they marry multiple people and they have thriving marriages while they're good. And that's, Elizabeth Taylor got married 8 times and she was happy all 8 times, I think, when she got married.
Yeah. Well, you know, then you got to make it work. And, you know, that's, you
and
know,
that's hard.
But here's the other thing. The other question I get asked about marriage as we conclude this episode, Nia, is by some of my younger students. Why is it that states can place age thresholds on when you can get married? And I said, it flows from the state government's police power, because they can make decisions to regulate for public health and safety. And I said, and remember, guys, young people, children, do not have the full scope of rights and privileges that adults enjoy.
Right. Your daughter cannot enter into a contract.
No. Not at 10 years.
Because she's assumed to not have the ability to consent to a contract. And that's what marriage is. It's assumed that she might fall in love with one of the BTS singers, right? One of the K-pop boys. And he might fall in love with her. And they might decide they want to get married. Although that's weird because they're in their 20s. But you know what I mean. She doesn't have the mental capacity, theoretically under the law, to consent to understanding what that actually means, what it means to get married or sign a contract, or whatever.
Yeah, the concept in law is informed consent. Okay.
Right.
But some
states set that marriage informed consent at 14, which I think is criminal, personally.
But the trend is actually to raise it up to at least 16, if not 18.
Good.
Okay.
Because it should be, frankly. That's a big decision to make for a person who's not.
And of course, who
hasn't gone to prom yet? I mean, that's.
Well, and of course, listeners, does that mean that the, you know, potentially rare young person who's mature and knows what they want has their interests and desires limited by the government? Sure.
Yes.
Okay. But again,
you're protecting the larger group, not
you're protecting the collective at sometimes the expense of the individual.
Right.
And
hardly anybody's ever died from waiting to get married.
That is true.
I mean, it doesn't seem to be a thing that ends in, except for Romeo and Juliet, it does not end in complete failure most of the time. Thanks, Augie. This has been a good one.
We could probably do an entire episode on the political science critique of Romeo and Juliet, but that's for a different episode.
Yes, that's for a different episode and years off.
I really enjoyed this conversation. And listeners, this was a topic that Nia has wanted to do for a long time, and we finally got around to doing it. So
There are other things that you think are in the Constitution, or you think other people think are in the Constitution and aren't, email us, because we can always do a follow-up episode, because there's more. There are always things that people will say to you in an argument, it's in the Constitution. And because if you say that to me, just be aware that the first thing I'm going to say is, where? Cite your source. Where in the Constitution is it? And if you can't answer that question, I'm going to make fun of you. Okay. Thank you so much, Augie. And we'll talk again soon.
All right. Thanks, Nia. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Civil Discourse, brought to you by VCU Libraries. Opinions expressed are solely the speaker's own and do not reflect the views or opinions of VCU or VCU Libraries. Special thanks to the workshop for technical assistance. Music by Isaac Hobson. Find more information at guides.library.vcu.edu/discourse. As always, no documents were harmed in the making of this podcast.